Good afternoon. You're listening to Unusual Sources on 93.3 CFMU FM. Our first guest today is one of America's foremost political scientists, social commentators, and historians, Dr. Michael Parenti. Now, Dr. Parenti is a prolific author, and his most recent book is entitled Contrary Notions, A Michael Parenti Reader. But the focus of our interview today is going to be all the discussion on Yugoslavia in the media surrounding former Bosnian Serb leader Karadzic. We're going to be focusing on the subject matter of Dr. Parenti's book, To Kill a Nation, The Attack on Yugoslavia. And of course, that's a book you can buy in print. And if you're interested in Dr. Parenti's articles, you can find them at michaelparenti.org. But now we're going to be going over to Peter interviewing Dr. Parenti.
We've invited Michael on the show to talk about the current situation and the past situation in the former Republic of Yugoslavia. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for taking your time to be on the show. Michael, the reason we're on this topic is because over the last 7-8 days, with the arrest of Karadzic, the former leader of the Bosnian Serbs, and his arraignment in front of the International Criminal Court, there's been a lot of replaying of what happened in Yugoslavia. And we know you've written on the subject quite extensively. I guess the question going forward is this whole concept that it was a Serbian problem, and that's what led to the breakup of Yugoslavia. How do you react to that?
Well, Serbs were much dedicated to maintaining Yugoslavia as a federation. The breakup came because certain elements in Croatia and Slovenia and Kosovo and also in Bosnia, which were incited and financed by outside intelligence interests, specifically German and U.S., instigated and agitated for separation. But to say that the Serbs somehow were responsible for the breakup of Yugoslavia isn't really true. I mean, I think the U.S. policymakers were of the opinion that Yugoslavia had to go. Here was a country that was socialist. I mean, over 85% of its economy was still publicly owned, and it was a rather substantial size in the middle of Central Europe. It was tolerated when there was a whole string of communist countries in the Soviet Union, and but it didn't have to be tolerated anymore. There with the rollback in Eastern Europe and such, here was this country still going its own way, showing no interest in joining the EU and no interest in joining NATO or anything of the sort. And it was a social democracy. It had a democratically elected Slobodan Milosevic in its, second election, I guess, after it started having elections and such. So it had to go, and it has. It's been broken up. It's been broken up into a cluster of right-wing mini-republics where everything has been privatized, everything has been deregulated, large-scale unemployment. The Yugoslav construction industry that competed with Western capital has been abolished. The Yugoslav automobile industry has been abolished, pretty much. And you have the kind of goal that the transnational corporate globalists have been going for. It's called the third worldization of everywhere, including Europe and North America.
It's interesting because the debate as carried out in the Western media and our media was whether Milosevic and the Yugoslavian government was totalitarian, in fact, maniacal, in the sense that Milosevic and Karadzic have been both described as Hitlerite.
Right, maniacal, yeah.
Yeah, and it seemed to dominate even the debate amongst the intellectuals, progressive intellectuals in this continent.
That's right. Progressive intellectuals were out there standing shoulder to shoulder with NATO, bombing Yugoslavia 78 days, standing shoulder to shoulder with the U.S. Pentagon, bombing Yugoslavia and destroying social democracy. These same progressives oppose the war in Iraq. Why? Why do they oppose a war against a militaristic dictator who killed many people, Saddam Hussein? By the way, I oppose that war too, and we all should oppose that war. I'm not saying they shouldn't. But if they oppose that war, why did they support a war against Yugoslavia that hadn't attacked anybody, that hadn't invaded anybody, that wasn't persecuting anyone? But it really shows the power of the propaganda machine that was cooked up here, and people were absolutely sold on the idea that for the first time, and probably the last, they could support this war because it's a humanitarian war that the U.S. is waging. Suddenly, the U.S. is worried about some Muslims or Albanians in Yugoslavia. Isn't there something a little odd about it? Wouldn't you want to question it a little further? And the truth of the matter is, you know, that in the Hague trial, that trumped-up court that they had against Milosevic, according to Carla Del Ponte herself, who was the kangaroo court's hanging judge, according to her herself, at the end of the case they laid out on Milosevic, she said it's going to be hard to prove that he committed any kind of genocide. The charge of genocide just can't stick. There's just no evidence for it. They kept kicking around 7,000, Bill Moyers, I heard him say, 7,000 men and boys were slaughtered in Srebrenica. They never found 7,000 bodies. They found about 150 or so of undefined nationality and cause of death. 100,000 Albanian young men were killed in Kosovo. And when they took over Kosovo, they didn't find that. They found about 2,000 graves, again, of people of undefined nationality or cause of death. And they went hunting around. The FBI came in and said, this is the largest forensic scene in our history. And they stayed for less than a week and said, we can't find anything. And that's the problem when you keep ascribing all these mass atrocities to your enemy, and then you take over the territory he's occupying, and that you better come up with the bodies, and they don't. And they made up stories that, well, the Serbs must have dug up all these bodies and planted them somewhere else. what did they learn between the first burial and the second burial that made the second burial so successful, or both burials really so successful? It got really crazy. The NATO report that 100,000 Albanian women in detention camps had given birth to babies in that period, a one month period there. 100,000 Albanian women gave birth. The implication was they had all been raped, but 9 months before there hadn't been any war. What were they talking about? And yet this stuff all went out, ethnic cleansing. The only people who were ethnically cleansed in Kosovo were the Serbs and the Jews and the Romani and every other non-Albanian. They were kicked out, and many Albanians who cooperated with the government and who had federal jobs, they were murdered themselves by the KLA, which the U.S. State Department itself called a terrorist organization. Until the war started, then they became great Kosovo patriots.
Well, that's an important. I guess that's an important fact to remind our listeners too about the ethnic cleansing of the Serbs. I mean, one of the probably the worst atrocity in the war was the cleansing of the Serbs out of Croatia, which I remember the Yugoslavian government appealed to the international community, and not a word was said. About a quarter of a million Serbs were pushed out of an area in Croatia within a period of a week.
Yeah, that's right. They were kicked out, and the Croatians came along and claimed their houses and ownership of their farms and the like. And these were people who had been living there for centuries.
No, they were referred to as colonists from
right.
The irony.
It's a disgrace the way people who suppose who claim to be progressive and radical. It's a disgrace to see how they fell in line on that issue, and refused to look at the evidence.
Well, the term Balkanization, which you know is very describes the situation perfectly. The reason for the Balkanization of Yugoslavia and for breaking it up, you stated at the beginning this was part of what the Americans and Germans wanted. Could you elaborate further? I mean, in terms of their own political, economic interests, political interests, or?
Well, in terms of what kind of world we are going to fashion or allow to exist for the needs of international global finance capital, really is what it gets down to. Do you want a world of independent, self-developing, self-defined countries, or do you want a world where these countries are all part of the global free market system as we define it? And the answer is you want the latter. So any country that charts an independent course, any country that decides it's going to use its land and labor and capital and markets and natural resources for its own benefits and profits rather than for the benefits and profits of international investors, multinational corporate investors, any country that does that will be targeted as being hostile, oppressive, dangerous to peace and stability, guilty of committing atrocities and such. And some of those countries are not run by angels, it's true, as Iraq with Saddam Hussein. But you can't point to Yugoslavia and you can't point to Milosevic rounding up thousands of people and torturing them and killing them. There just aren't the court took 2 years and they could not establish that Milosevic had committed such crimes, and they're going to run into the same problem with the present Karadzic. And I think
the court keeps on saying they've learned their lesson from Milosevic, and they were not going to allow the same thing to happen with Karadzic. It's interesting. What does that mean?
They lost the case with Milosevic, and when he was about to launch his defense, he died very conveniently. But what they argue is that he filibustered in the court, and he made it drag on for 2 years. Well, that's not true. They're the ones who brought in all these witnesses that covered a 2-year period. He had the right to cross-examine them, and in case after case, they would collapse and say, "I really don't know. I really wasn't there. I was told to say this, this, that, and the other thing." And it's a remarkable story. You never hear a word of it. There was almost no coverage given in the media, and no coverage was given because the case was not going well. And Milosevic insisted on being his own lawyer, although he had two other lawyers there in assistance, but it was because he felt he knew things better than the lawyers they were going to appoint, and he wasn't sure of the veracity or dedication of the lawyers that they would appoint. And so so this is what they mean by we've learned our lesson with Milosevic. They're gonna steamroll this guy right through real quick and neat. Toward the end, they were making up all sorts of new rules with Milosevic to say, you're getting only 10 minutes to cross-examine this witness or cross-examine that one, and so forth, trying to restrict him and such. And then when he was going to launch his defense, after they took 2 years to put the prosecution's case forward, they said he would get, I think it was a matter of a couple of months. I mean, all the stuff on Bosnia, all the stuff on Croatia, all the stuff on Kosovo, he would need more than 2 months, obviously. But as I say, he died. He himself said, "They are killing me." He felt that he was being poisoned.
Right, and whether
and there wasn't there was an alien substance found in him by one of the coroners, who then made the statement that he was probably ingesting this alien substance to induce or mimic a heart attack, so that we would let him, we would send him off to Russia, where he could be treated by doctors, and he would be united with his wife, and he would refuse to come back. That was the cock and bull story that was then. Where the hell did you get that scenario from? What evidence is there for that? Why would you send him off to Russia? Why would he expect you to do that? He knew you would look at him with your own doctors only. He was your prisoner. But that was a very interesting admission that they found the substances in him. Where did he get the substances? Who smuggled that in for him if it was his own?
Well,
so Karadzic better watch what he eats, I would say. Although I guess they couldn't have him die also. You notice, though, for the other side, the war criminals do all right. There was Orish, you know, the Muslim war criminal who had done a lot of killing. He was let go. They say insufficient evidence. And then there was the KLA war criminal, Haradani, and he was let go just recently. Very two high-profile leaders. No evidence. You know, no direct evidence that they were directly involved in any kinds of atrocities. Well, that's true of Milosevic too, but they were trying him on indirect involvement.
Well, you know, there's many different angles to this, but one of the things that you wrote about at the time, and we should remind people, is that the leadership of the so-called nationalist movements that were being supported by, you know, human rights interventionists in North America, you know, compared to Milosevic, who was ideologically a socialist and you know, and obviously a nationalist to his nation, Yugoslavia. Tudjman, who became elected the president of Croatia, was an open apologist for the Nazis during World War II.
That's right. Franz Tudjman was an active member of the Ustasi, who were Croatian Nazi SS members. And Tudjman was supported by the U.S. That's correct. And it was he who who led many of the attacks against the Serbs. And in Bosnia, you had Izetbegovic as the leader, and Izetbegovic was himself a member of the Muslim SS. He was a Hitler Youth Nazi himself in his youth. And these were the people that the U.S. was supporting. And, you know, the irony, if you talk to any number of people, including progressive ones, it's like little snippets they pick up, and they just repeat it like parrots. Say, oh, Milosevic, well, he was a Serbian nationalist. You know, he was one of the few leaders who wasn't a nationalist in the sense of ethnic nationalist. He was a federalist nationalist. He was for keeping Yugoslavia together, and he denounced nationalism again and again, of the other kind, ethnic nationalism. His wife wrote a book condemning the ethnic nationalism, that we should not be thinking in terms of Croatian or Serb or Bosnian or Kosovo or Albanian and such. We should be thinking in terms of a multi-ethnic society.
And the irony was that Yugoslavia, in many ways, was a beacon. I mean, if people remember the Winter Olympics at Sarajevo, I remember watching it, and one of the statistics was that there was more intermarriage between Muslims, Croats, and Serbs than anywhere. I mean, in terms of intermarriage, in terms of percentage of the population, it was a phenomenal amount of intermarriage.
That's right. If it had gone another couple of generations, they would not have been able to split it up probably this way. It was just happening that way. People were, if given the chance, moved to each other and look at each other in terms of their lives, their feelings, and their hearts, and not according to some national or ethnic label. And I'll tell you something else. When I was in Yugoslavia after the 78 days of bombing. I think it was July 1999. The only country left in Yugoslavia that was still multi-ethnic was Serbia itself, ironically enough. That you had the cleansing and the sort of partitioning of Bosnia into Serbian Bosnia and Muslim Bosnia. You had the horrible ethnic cleansing in Croatia that you mentioned before, Ukraine. But in Serbia, you had people, and you were getting ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, which continues to this day, although the media never once call it ethnic cleansing. But in Serbia, you had about 20,000 Albanians living there. You had Croatians who lived there. You had Muslims. It was the one place where there wasn't any cleansing out. There were Serb right-wing nationalists, but they were not running the show. But they were gaining some strength because, you know, when other nationalists victimize your people, then your people start reacting in a countervailing way, same way. But Serbia, and even to this day, Serbia is probably the only one of these republics that hasn't been ethnically cleansed. By the way, I want to say there were atrocities committed by Serb paramilitaries, but the numbers were grossly exaggerated. The Serbs do not maintain that they are angels. They're about the only one of the people who don't maintain their angels. The Muslims and the Kosovars, Albanians, and the Croatians all maintain that they are spotless and without any crime to speak of.
Now, it's also interesting that there's been a lot of, critical thinkers. I shouldn't say a lot, because there's not a lot of critical thinkers in the West, but there's been a couple that have said that the situation in Yugoslavia became the template for what the Americans did in Iraq. This discussion about, you know, when they talk about all their, aside from, if you don't believe they went there to liberate Iraq or to democratize it, but, you know, which I'm assuming most people listening to this program probably agree with us, but there was another thing, the breaking up of a sovereign nation into small sort of little cantons that can never be effective as organized states, and that became the sort of template for dealing with Iraq.
That's correct, and that's been a goal various places around the world. In Bolivia right now, the right wingers are trying to cut the eastern provinces off and break up Bolivia. And they've done this in various other places. Yugoslavia, though, is really the textbook case. I mean, it is the premier example of how you can destroy a country by teaching separatism and such. You see, I don't believe a country should be formed around an ethnicity, because that means you're saying this is not a democratic polity where people of all different strains and backgrounds and all live and democratically, as we have in Canada and in the U.S. supposedly. I mean, at least there are no ethnic restrictions as to who can live or not live here, although there are discriminatory immigration policies and such that often victimize people. But still, it's an individual citizen, and you don't automatically become a citizen because you're of this blood and automatically be banned from citizenship because you're of that blood, you see. So when you do that, every time you form a republic for a people, you create other minorities. You said this minority should have its own country. Okay, so you create the country. And what happens? There are minorities within the minorities and such. Kosovo should belong to the Albanians. Well, you know, before World War II, the majority of the people in Kosovo were Serbs, and they were driven out, a lot of them by the Nazis and such. Albanians moved in substantial numbers and became the majority, probably about 60%. They were never 90% as the media kept reporting, but they were about 60%. And Tito decided to leave it the way it was. Well, as reported in the New York Times, what's happened since World War II was a concerted campaign to drive Serbs off their farms and out, and intimidation and the like. And that's been going on by the Albanian KLA nationalists and to take over a country and make it Kosovo for the Albanians. And they've driven out, as I said before, literally tens of thousands of Serbs, Jews, Gorani, Romani, and various other peoples, just driven them out. So this idea, it sounds like a good idea, self-determination. Oh, that's beautiful. I mean, what a term. You could almost weep. Yes, self-determination. But what it really means is there's got to be a blood test for you to be a member of this polity, and you've got to be of a certain blood. Well, actually, that's a Nazi self-determination test, and that's not really what we want. We want societies that are multi-ethnic and with people living in peace and celebrating their differences as well as their similarities.
Well, the irony is I was reading an interview with the former foreign affairs minister for the Bosnian government during the war, Sakarbe. Now he's complaining that Bosnia has just become a protectorate of NATO, which is Kosovo has become too, because the creation of Bosnia and then dividing Bosnia up into three different cantons, it's not going to exist. It's never going to exist as an independent state. So
that's
no matter
right.
what his motivation is, he's realized that this has all become, this has been for naught. This is, I mean, they're not creating independent states, they're creating dependencies of NATO and the United States.
That's right, little NATO protectorates, so to speak. Yeah, and when the Serb Republic of Bosnia Skripska, when they elected a guy that the NATO people didn't want, they just simply removed him. There was a democratic election, and they just removed him. When they had one radio station left of their own, I document all this in my book, To Kill the Nation, The Attack on Yugoslavia. The one radio station, and it was shut down by the NATO peacekeepers, and there was some odd thought in the article. There was an amusing report in the New York Times, which kept talking about Serbian hardliners. The only radio station they had, and the reporter had to kind of twist around and say, how do I explain that the NATO people are the purveyors of democracy while they're shutting down the one dissenting radio station in all of Bosnia? And he said, well, it's for the better because, then you can get more objective media, and that this station wasn't really objective. So as I'm saying, the reader, if they are interested, can go check
yes.
out my book, To Kill a Nation, The Attack on Yugoslavia.
And we can get
I
that
and give my website to you guys?
Yes, please do.
It's just michaelparenti.org.
michaelparenti.org. And,
.org.
.org. And, of course, To Kill a Nation, which is about Yugoslavia, and you have many other very interesting books on this subject and many others.
I have a couple of articles right on my website. One of them is called The Rational Destruction of Yugoslavia, which argues that this thing was done for the interests of, Western aggrandizement.
I mean, I guess the lesson I'm learning, we're all starting to learn this, is that a nation has a right to self-determination until it disagrees with the West, and then it has the right to being intervened under the name of humanitarian intervention.
Yeah, well put. That's exactly right.
Well, listen, Michael, we will continue to tell people about your website and your books, and we urge people that really want to do a truly academic analysis of what's happened there and get to the facts, because this has been, I mean, Michael, what you give to us is what very few academics nowadays do is you take a cold, hard look at the facts and let the facts guide you to what is really happening. It's a pleasure to hear from you, and we urge people to read your literature and your books.
Right. Well, thank you very much, friend. Thanks, and keep up your good work, right?
Okay, thank you. And that was
Michael. Bye-bye.
Bye.